Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a brand new episode of The Financial Confessions. It's me, your host, Chelsea Fagan, founder and CEO of The Financial Diet and woman who loves to talk about money. And I want to start this episode with a content warning because we are going to talk about some pretty heavy topics that we don't often get into here on the channel too explicitly, topics that can be triggering and upsetting. And that is a lot to do with disordered eating as well as disordered relationships to one's own body and the food that we're putting in it. Now, that is not to say that this is going to be all about that, but I do want to be very clear that those are topics we'll touch on. So if they're hard for you to listen to right now or in general, I will not take offense at all if you tune out. Those of you who follow me on TikTok might have seen a TikTok I posted recently that blew up in a minor way. I'm not going to say it was viral or anything, but it definitely got a bit of a conversation going because I came across a video that really upset me to see on just like a personal level, but also upset me to see that it had, at the time of my recording my TikTok, over 1 million views and tons of people in the comments talking about how they too love to do this or love the idea. Basically, an influencer, I'm not really familiar with her, posted a video of her like favorite low-calorie dessert that she referred to as her dessert lasagna. And when I saw an image of it, those of you watching YouTube can see what it looks like here. I actually thought this was some sort of gummy candy or cubed up jello. It turns out that it is indeed just a glass full of crushed ice into which she pours Crystal Light packets. And she calls it lasagna because she does layers of ice with layers of Crystal Light. So I stitched that video and I talked about how I found it pretty upsetting, especially in the dead of summer when a lot of us are already hyper-conscious about, for example, what our bodies might look like in bathing suits, and we're inundated with all kinds of messaging about needing to lose weight and needing to focus on calories and so forth. But again, to see that for as far as we've supposedly come with a lot of body image stuff and our narratives around how we should be treating our bodies and what we should be putting in them, we're still subject to a lot of the same really toxic diet culture that has plagued women for basically as long as women have been aware of themselves, and certainly other people have been aware of them as well. We've talked about it before on this channel, but it's always worth reiterating. We live in a very, very confusing time when it comes to things like wellness, and many of us are still navigating minefields of body image and disordered relationships to food that are being presented to us often under the guise of being healthy alternatives or being self-care in some cases. To navigate this can feel impossible, but it's important to arm ourselves with the right tools. And recently, the TFD Society Book Club had a book club pick by my guest today. This book actually came out on April 25th of this year. It's available where all books are found. We'll link you in the description. Shop independent if you can. It's called The Wellness Trap, and it's all about navigating this faux sense of wellness, as well as all of the content and messaging we're surrounded by, both on social media and in the rest of our lives. I'd like to thank Nutrafol for supporting TFC. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement. You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support TFC by going to Nutrafol.com and entering the promo code TFC to save $10 off your first month subscription plus free shipping on every order. Thanks to Kelly Blue Book Service Advisor for supporting TFC. Kelly Blue Book Service Advisor helps you identify top local auto repair shops and get the fairest prices. Learn more at kbb.com/service-repair-guide or click the link in the episode description. She's a registered dietitian. She's also a specialist in eating disorders, as well as intuitive eating, and has a lot of extremely fascinating things to say on these topics and more. It's been one of our members' favorite book club picks of the whole year, and I'm so excited to share her with the broader audience here on TFC. Without further ado, I welcome my guest, Christy Harrison. Hi!
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. So I obviously gave a little bit of your credentials, but could you just start us off by talking about what you do as well as your philosophy as it pertains to eating and wellness?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm a registered dietitian. I like to say I'm an anti-diet registered dietitian because that immediately sort of subverts people's idea of what a dietitian is. I'm also a journalist. I've been a journalist for more than 20 years, and that's actually sort of my leading profession in a lot of ways. Like, it's what I always wanted to do when I grew up. That's what I sort of went into for the passion, the love of it. And I think I got sort of sidetracked into becoming a dietitian by my own disordered eating issues. And so now I work to help people people recover from disordered eating themselves, to heal their relationships with food and their bodies from this anti-diet perspective. So not putting people on diets, not promoting weight loss or, you know, demonizing particular foods or anything like that, but really helping people have a relaxed, intuitive, easy, peaceful relationship with food the way that we all deserve and the way that we're all born being able to do before we get, you know, sidelined by diet culture. So yeah, that's a little bit about what I do. I wrote two books, Anti-Diet, which came out in 2019, just before the pandemic, and then The Wellness Trap, which came out this past April, as you said. And so it's been really interesting to see sort of how the culture has shifted since writing that first book and just the ways that wellness culture has become even more insidious. And there have been even more scams and rabbit holes of misinformation out there since the pandemic that I really wanted to explore in the second book.
Well, as someone who's pretty familiar with the publishing industry, condolences for having a book come out right before the pandemic. That's a very rough time for a book to come out.
Thank you.
So for those who may not have read the book yet, although everyone should, what is The Wellness Trap?
Yeah, so the idea of The Wellness Trap is that wellness culture is a trap that hooks people in through promises of better health, better well-being, and this sort of sense of like totally optimized health. So if you're someone with chronic illnesses like me who struggle to find help and support in the conventional healthcare system, I think it can be really appealing because it feels like you're taking matters into your own hands, you're getting the help and the empathy and support that you need. Oftentimes, under the umbrella of wellness, falls alternative and complementary medicine, which is increasingly being sort of rebranded as integrative and functional medicine. And those types of approaches to health really make people feel heard and understood a lot of the times. There's, you know, often more empathy to be found in those spaces. And the approaches that they're offering often are ineffective and even harmful. And so I look at the issues with that in The Wellness Trap, you know, with the complementary and alternative and integrative medicine industries. I also look at, you know, that even if you're not someone with chronic illnesses or conditions and you don't have a lot of interaction with the conventional healthcare system, I think there's this sort of other side of wellness that is, well, you can prevent ever having to deal with those things, right? You can, you know, even if you have a family history of something, you can outrun it and make sure you don't get it and sort of hack your genetics and prevent ever getting sick. Or, you know, if you feel really great, well, you could always feel greater, right? There's always something more you could be doing. And I think this really ties in to a lot of other issues that we have in American culture, sort of, you know, rugged individualism, optimization of all things, and this sort of sense of personal responsibility that, you know, it's your responsibility to prevent yourself from ever getting sick, and that if you do, it's your fault. And but, you know, never fear, there are all these things that you could be doing to make yourself better, and you could put your diseases into remission if you just find the right, you know, key and tools to sort of unlock that. And so there are all these people who are exploiting those promises and sort of making people feel like, preying on this sense of it being your fault and it being your responsibility, and making false promises that, you know, are ultimately really harmful. And I came to see this through, you know, the reason I wanted to write this book was manifold. There's lots of reasons for this. But one reason was, you know, in my work as a dietitian, helping people heal from eating disorders, and also in my personal struggle of healing from eating disorders and disordered eating, I've really found that wellness culture dovetails so much with diet culture that when people go into these wellness spaces looking for help with, you know, gut health or healing an autoimmune condition or healing some skin condition they're having or whatever it might be, that they end up getting put on these diets that, you know, become rabbit holes into disordered eating. They get put on restrictive diets, you know, most of the time, that in and of themselves are really disordered and taking people away from the intuitive relationship with food that I spoke about, that's really, you know, the peaceful way that I think we all deserve to eat. And then people end up, you know, oftentimes having more and more symptoms develop when they're on these restrictive diets that then get blamed on, well, you're just not doing it hard enough, or you need to be adding these supplements or adding these different protocols, or, you know, maybe you're sensitive to even more foods than we thought, and so you need to cut out even more. And so it becomes this, you know, snowball effect into seriously disordered eating. And I think that, you know, people need to be aware of that happening. And I think there are a lot of ways that it hooks us in sort of subtle ways that we're not so aware of through social media algorithms. You know, you mentioned TikTok. There's evidence that TikTok and other social media platforms have radicalized people who are looking for health, you know, quote unquote, healthy eating advice or workout routines, will come in with, you know, searching for that kind of content and very quickly get pulled into these extreme diets, pro eating disorder content, and content that really, you know, demonizes larger bodies and makes them feel ashamed for their food choices and makes people, you know, feel like they need to do even more extreme things to take care of themselves. So all of that was, you know, material I wanted to explore in this new book.
So we did get an enormous amount of questions from the audience, which we will get to. But before we do on all of those topics and more, but before we do so, you know, as I mentioned in the intro, coming across that TikTok, which, you know, is not that outlandish in some ways in terms of a lot of the content that is available out there, it still really took me by surprise in the sense that I think for most of us, like, there's a sort of internal litmus test, because obviously there can be a very, very fine line between what is really considered disordered eating or what is considered an abnormal or unhealthy relationship with food. And I think that there is an intuitive sense for many people of, like, you know, there's a big difference between, hey, I'm going to be mindful of, you know, having a balanced diet in terms of macronutrients. I'm going to be mindful of, you know, calories. I'm going to be mindful of how I feel, all of those things. And I'm going to get to a place of, you know, extreme restriction or hypervigilance that's detrimental or any of those things. And for me, when I see a video, and it's not so much necessarily, oh, I'm referring to a cup of ice with, you know, a packet of aspartame sprinkled on it as dessert. Like, I think that in and of itself is a bit problematic. But to even highlight it in terms of, oh, this is only 10 calories. When I see that, that to me immediately raises so many red flags about how it's being framed, you know, what it is promoting, the relationship with food that it's encouraging, or the way of thinking about food that it's encouraging. But I was surprised to see in the comments on the original video and some of the comments on mine, people saying, oh, this is really helpful for people who are, you know, counting calories, for doing this, for doing that. You know, this can be beneficial and non-harmful. And in many ways, I think that that sort of framing of, like, oh, well, for some people, this could be helpful, sort of prevents us from being more direct about calling out certain behaviors or certain, you know, ideas that are being promoted, and can keep us in this constant loop of, like, well, even the most extreme and restrictive diets or most, you know, superficially toxic framing of things could be beneficial for a certain person. So my question for myself, really, and then honestly for everyone listening, is, like, how do we hone our BS meter as far as, this is really unhealthy messaging or really unhealthy framing about food, without necessarily condemning everything that is, you know, that has anything to do with calories or anything to do with restricting in any way?
Yeah, well, I would sort of pull back a little bit from that question first and talk about what the evidence actually says in that regard, because I think a lot of people do think, you know, you can have sort of a light touch with this stuff. You can, you know, count calories loosely or just be mindful or just watch what you eat. And, you know, that's healthy and that's different from the sort of extreme restriction that a lot of people get into. But actually what I've found in my own clinical work, what I've found in my personal, you know, healing with this stuff, and what we see in the scientific literature, there's a couple of studies that have shown this sort of evidence-based way, is that the line between those two things is very fluid, and in fact they exist on a continuum on which people slide back and forth. So you can't, it's called flexible dietary control in the literature, you know, the sort of light watching it, maybe being mindful of calories, etc. You can't actually have flexible dietary control without being at risk of sliding into rigid dietary control, and most people slide back and forth on that continuum over time, and so they never quite get away from the specter of rigid dietary control. I think when there's flexible dietary control, there's always rigid dietary control sort of lurking around the corner, right? So when you're, you know, I think of it as kind of the spectrum of disordered eating too, right? It's like you can have disordered eating that is not sort of fully aligned and intuitive and in touch with your relationship with your body and with, you know, your hunger and fullness cues and your body's needs, where you're kind of living in your head and you're counting calories or counting macros. And, you know, that's taking you away from this intuitive relationship with your body that really, I think, is the goal in my work with people and in sort of fostering a peaceful relationship with food and, you know, and good well-being overall. You can have that and, you know, you're not totally disordered. You're not over at this end of the spectrum that is, you know, having this supposed lasagna stand in for a real dessert or, you know, counting calories down to the incremental number and being really rigid about it and never deviating and all of that stuff that, you know, really characterizes a full-blown eating disorder. And yet you're still in this sort of disordered space where you're not actually trusting your body, letting food be neutral, not worrying about food in this sort of way that I think calorie counting or watching it or flexible dietary control encourages, right? And what we see in the literature is that intuitive eating is actually its own separate construct. It's off of that continuum from rigid to flexible dietary control. It's its own thing that is, you know, separate and has been associated with so many better health outcomes than dieting. And we see, you know, in some randomized control trials as well, that it actually leads to better health outcomes than dieting. So I think that's really interesting context to this conversation. And, you know, so what I would say in response to that is, you know, ask yourself where you fall on that continuum. And if you truly feel like you've only been in the flexible dietary control space, or if there's rigid dietary control in your past and perhaps in your future and sort of, you know, lurking around the edges, right? Maybe you think you're sort of relaxed about it, but then when you actually look a little bit deeper, you're like, oh, right, I won't let myself eat carbs, or I won't let myself eat after X p.m. in the evening, or, you know, I have these rules about food that I'm sort of wedded to, and I think it's because of health, but it's also kind of because of weight, and I also don't really know, like, the solid evidence base behind it. It was maybe something that I heard from, you know, an influencer or a diet guru, or, you know, maybe even my doctor, but who was sort of not a dietitian, not someone who was giving detailed nutrition information, but sort of maybe tossing off something, because doctors, unfortunately, aren't really trained in nutrition for the most part. And so doctors will often say things like, oh, well, you know, X diet works for me, or I've seen, you know, a couple of patients have success with this, and they sort of, you know, extrapolate out from there. And so kind of really looking at, like, the root of your food rules and your ways of being around food, and sort of making sure that, you know, I think there's always often some rigidity lurking there that people aren't aware of. And so being really honest with yourself about that, right? And I think when we are honest with ourselves about that, we see that, you know, really in no peaceful relationship with food is someone worrying about 10 calories, right? In no peaceful relationship with food is someone saying, well, I'm hungry for a sweet or a dessert, but I'm not allowed to have any sort of sugar. And this includes even people with diabetes, right? Because people with diabetes are often told that they have to avoid sugar at all costs. And that really isn't true. There are ways to have sugar as a balanced part of your meal plan with diabetes, and to sort of plan for that with medication and food planning and stuff like that, and sort of seeing how different things affect your individual blood sugar. So anyway, you know, people can have dessert and, you know, not worry about it and not be counting calories down to that minute amount or at all, you know. And I think if you're not feeling free enough to do that, if you're not feeling flexible enough to do that, it's really a sign that there is some disorder in your relationship with food. Not to say that you have a full-blown eating disorder, but that you probably fall somewhere in that spectrum of disordered eating, as opposed to, you know, what I would say is ordered eating, I guess, which is intuitive eating, you know, just relaxed eating that's not thinking about all of those external forces.
From a financial perspective, there is obviously, first and foremost, the diet industry, the wellness industry, the supplement industry, which, by the way, I have to shout out our episode of Too Good to Be True this season, all about the supplements and essential oils industries, which are by and large scams. But obviously those industries are extremely lucrative and essentially always have been. But kind of separate from just the financial incentives of these industries, there's also, and I think, you know, this has always been true to an extent with diet, but I think especially with wellness, at least in my perception, there's been a real ramp up of the class signifiers that really tie in and dovetail with wellness as a concept. You know, obviously you have the Gwyneth Paltrow phenomenon. You have things like, I can't open my TikTok anymore without seeing someone in Erewhon, which is like, you know, as much about like, look at how expensive all of these items are as it is about the actual food itself, which I have it on good authority is not very good. But there's, I think, a real sense of wellness as a concept, but especially sort of like the wellness food and beverages as luxury items, of items that confer status and worth and are also kind of a way to buy into luxury without necessarily, like, you can't maybe afford a Chanel bag, but you can afford the smoothie that the girl with the Chanel bag is drinking in her TikTok or her Instagram post. And it's obviously very difficult to untangle the class and wealth signifiers we have about any given purchase in our lives. But how do you, first of all, especially when you were going through disordered eating, was there a class or status element to it for you? Mm-hmm. And how do you see people tangling and then, in the best case scenario, disentangling those two aspects as a part of their recovery?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I think there very much is a class element to this and a class signifier element to those kinds of foods, to certain kinds of practices as well, like, you know, going to expensive group fitness classes or, you know, seeing a naturopath instead of a medical doctor in some communities. I think there's a real like class signifier element to that, and not just class necessarily, but also sort of like subcultural status in some cases too, right? Like being part of a subculture that's creative and sort of non-traditional and, you know, doesn't just go to a regular doctor. I think there's a lot of status wrapped up in that too. I definitely myself was subject to that. I was very caught up in, you know, it's ironic because it's the time in my life when I had the least amount of money, when I was struggling the most in my relationship with food and my body. And yet, you know, I was buying the most expensive food that I've ever bought. And I think part of that was this messaging that like that was the purest, best way to be, that was like the ethical way to be, that I had to buy, you know, only organic and local and sustainable, because if I didn't, I was destroying the planet or contributing to this terrible food system, and I wanted to be a part of the change. So there was a lot of like ethics involved in it too. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, to have those ethics rests upon a certain level of financial security, right? To be able to make that choice, to be able to say, I'm gonna, you know, buy the more expensive thing as opposed to like the cheapest thing possible, you know, comes with being at a certain financial level and of a certain class. And, you know, even when I was the most broke I've ever been, and I was truly very broke, I also had, you know, a family that was financially stable and could have bailed me out and did bail me out in some cases, you know? So like there's that piece of it too, is like, I think a lot of people who are grappling with their class status, maybe sort of early in their careers, early in their adult lives, trying to figure out where they fit, these expensive foods and this sort of ethical stance is a way to kind of cement that like they're different in a way than, you know, other people who are broke, right? That it's like, you're, yes, you may be broke, but you can still afford these luxuries. You can still partake in this aspirational stuff that then is sort of like a lever to lift you up to a higher class status or something like that.
We're excited to once again be partnering with Nutrafol here on the Financial Confessions. We actually talk about Nutrafol a lot around the office since our marketing director, Rachel, started using it earlier this year. To be totally honest, hair growth is not something that personally affects me, so I'm happy that we found a product that has had a positive impact for someone else on our team. We all know men experience hair loss, but many women do too, even though it's not as openly spoken about. But here at TFD, we tend to speak pretty openly with each other, and Rachel has openly spoken a lot about dealing with postpartum hair loss, as well as general changes in her hair texture and thickness since giving birth. birth. After all of her other postpartum symptoms subsided, it's the one that has remained the longest. She's changed up the products she uses and stopped applying heat like hair dryers and curling irons completely, but nothing has made a real impact. She started taking 4 Nutrafol capsules every morning with breakfast and says she can already see a difference in the amount of hair she's shedding. We love that for her. Nutrafol supports healthy hair growth from within by targeting the 5 root causes of thinning: stress, hormones, environment, nutrition, and metabolism through whole body health. And in a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after 6 months. You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support our show by going to Nutrafol.com and entering the promo code TFC to save $10 off your first month subscription. This offer is only available to U.S. customers for a limited time, plus free shipping on every order. Get $10 off at Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code TFC. So if you're listening to this show, chances are that you own a car or are in the market to buy one. And you're likely familiar with Kelley Blue Book as the place you go when you want transparent, objective information to help you make the best financial decision when buying a car or looking to get auto repairs done. But you may not know about Service Advisor. Service Advisor is designed to help car owners identify the best local auto repair shops and find the fairest prices for services. Getting and maintaining a car is a true investment, and Kelley Blue Book Service Advisor helps you make the best financial decisions so that you can get the most out of your investment. With more than 95 years of experience, Kelley Blue Book is the trusted resource when it comes to car research, including new and used car pricing, repair and maintenance information, and advice for buying or selling your car, allowing consumers to navigate buying, selling, and owning a vehicle with confidence. Service Advisor provides insight on common problems car owners face using data from services others with similar vehicles have had performed, and also has a Q&A forum where owners can ask service-related questions so that you're never alone. They also answer key car ownership questions and provide personalized recommendations like what services to have done, when to have them performed locally, and most importantly, how much this should all cost based on similar repairs in the area. With access to customer reviews, service promotions, service center websites, and available service scheduling with price estimations, Kelley Blue Book Service Advisor helps car owners confidently identify top local auto repair shops and find the fairest prices for services. The 2 foundational pillars of Kelley Blue Book involve instilling trust and confidence in car shoppers and owners. Learn more about Kelley Blue Book Service Advisor at kbb.com/service-repair-guide or click the link in the episode description. Well, I mean, to your point about not wanting to participate in terrible systems, like, I think probably the most ludicrous example of this, and I, for the life of me, can't remember the brand. It was maybe General Mills. No, maybe it was Nestle. Anyway, one of, like, the objectively worst brands from just, like, an environmental perspective, a human rights perspective, like, a nutritional value perspective. Just one of these really, really horrible brands that I'm not going to sit here and say I never engage with any of their products. I do, but can say that they're definitely net negatives for the world. They had put out some video on social media. I want to say this was maybe a year ago or so that had, I guess, maybe the person in the video was a registered dietitian as well, had some credentials. But essentially was, you know, in the video kind of using the language of intuitive eating and talking about how, oh, well, no foods are good or bad. Like, you know, you can have these, and then, you know, showing the hyper ultra processed, nutritionally very, let's say, lean snack foods. And, you know, this is no better than a carrot or an apple or what have you, which, you know, there's a framing through which you could say, OK, that's true. On a moral level, perhaps, although if you were going to get into the impacts of each of those things, maybe not. But clearly there is, by, you know, the actors who stand to benefit from lax regulation, from, you know, a limited consumer awareness, limited consumer options. Like, there are a lot of bad actors within the food and beverage industries who definitely benefit from a perception that, you know, an item of fast food or a soda is just as good as, you know, an apple from the farmer's market or what have you. And there's a real cynicism to that as well when you think about, you know, all of the environmental and labor impacts behind it and what have you. So when it comes to being a conscientious consumer who wants to prioritize the best things that they can from those environmental, labor, et cetera, perspectives, and yet not demonize or stigmatize these other foods in a way that negatively impacts their relationship with their own eating or their perception of other people. How do you kind of find that balance?
It's a great question. I think, you know, one thing is to question the notion of the conscientious consumer in the first place, because I think that's a way of shifting responsibility onto the individual, right? Really, I think with, you know, environmental issues, the real thing that would have the most impact is regulation, government regulation of industries for, you know, creating pollution or other externalities, like for labor issues and human rights abuses. That's, I think, where we need to focus. And I think,
hey there, did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
This idea of consuming your way out of those problems is just a convenient distraction that actually benefits those industries. And look, you know, I'm no apologist for the food industry, for the beverage industry, for pharmaceuticals, et cetera. I think they all have a lot of issues for sure. And I think that demonizing those industries creates a lot more problems in people's relationships with food and their bodies than it needs to. Like, I think we need to not demonize those industries. Yes, focus on getting appropriate regulations, you know, voting for people who are going to put regulations on polluters and other bad actors at the corporate level. But in terms of, you know, individual choices, there's not a lot that your individual dollar or even a lot of our individual dollars together is really going to do to move the needle, except to say, you know, maybe there'll be more products on the market that sort of meet these esoteric dietary requirements or that respond to a perceived trend, right? That's what, you know, the sort of push for more gluten-free foods, for example, or the push for more organic foods. Like, yes, there have been changes in the market and more products that have come onto the market because of that. And I think that, you know, overall, the food industry has not really changed that much, even if there are more products responding to these perceived trends and needs. And individuals now get so wrapped up in knots about choosing the right thing and feeling like there's this huge moral responsibility and they make this huge impact through their buying decisions. And I want to say, like, that's just not true to a large extent, you know, for like, yes, there may be small ways in which you make a difference by buying one thing instead of another, or, you know, when it comes to like a smaller company and supporting that company or something like that. But the vote with your dollar concept, I think, is wildly overblown. And I see a lot of people take it to such an extreme that they put all of this pressure on themselves and the sense of responsibility for everything that goes into their mouths and everything that goes into their household and, you know, all of the products they buy, the beauty products and cleaning products and all of this stuff. And people can get so extremely obsessed with that kind of thing and spend so much of their budget on those things when maybe a more balanced, sort of peaceful relationship with food in their body and a more impactful way of changing the environment and labor systems and all of that is, you know, to buy the cheaper thing or to kind of be more relaxed about it and do what, you know, buy what you want when you want it and when you can afford a certain thing, and be working at the political level to actually make change, you know, to be calling your representatives all the time, like have them in your speed dial, have them, you know, call their offices every day, tell them what you want and organize and work with local groups to get those things passed, you know.
You know, I'm glad you said that because I definitely think there's a real push-pull between individual choice and ethical responsibility on that level. But I have found anecdotally in my own life, maybe there is data to back this up if you look at some studies, but I have found a lot in my own life that the people who tend to be hyper vigilant on an individual level about their choices tend to be often pretty disconnected politically, and in a lot of cases kind of disaffected politically. And I totally agree with you. Like, I'm very partial to phone banking and canvassing because I'm just, you know, I'm very extroverted. It's easy for me to talk to people. Don't mind getting yelled at. Yes, I will still be calling you about Bernie Sanders. Random man in Tennessee who yelled at me last time. So that feels like, to me, an easy and accessible way to help with these things. But I definitely agree with you that there tends to be a focus on individual choice that I agree can often really relieve the pressure on some of the more systemic solutions that actually will make a difference. And there's also, I think, to your point in the beginning, it really dovetails with this American ideal of the rugged individual and, you know, the family unit being its sort of its own little mini ecosystem, when in reality, ultimately, we are all making choices within a very specific set of constraints. And unless we change those constraints, it's going to be very, very difficult for anyone to make more sustainable changes on a societal level. And I definitely agree that if, you know, ethics is what you're focused on, to not be turning that as external as possible and as systemically as possible is, you know, at best maybe a missed opportunity, but also I think at worst a bit of a vanity project in terms of, you know, well, I get to say that everything in my home is of a certain quality, which often just translates to you being able to afford to do it. And therefore I'm one of the good ones. But I think the real question is, what are you doing on a more impactful level to actually make some of these changes accessible to people beyond just yourself and your individual home? So I really agree with that. As I mentioned in the intro, we got a ton of questions. So I'm going to go through and just kind of rapid fire through some of these.
I'll try to give rapid fire answers, although I tend to not do that.
Girls, you're preaching to the choir. I'm a rambler if there ever was one. A bit of a, you know, a dark question, but one I think that's worth asking because it was asked so many times. How do I know if I have an eating disorder?
Such a good question. So there are screening tools you can take online. There are, you know, talking to a therapist, right? You could start with your doctor if you have, you know, a primary care doctor that you trust, and expressing concern with your, you know, with your eating, with your relationship with food and your body, and asking for a referral to a psychotherapist. I will say that it's not always easy to find someone who's really well versed in eating disorders. I encountered many therapists in my eating disorder who didn't understand eating disorders, who weren't trained in that, and who sort of minimize things or spoke in weight stigmatizing ways that actually kind of made it worse and made it harder for me to share and get the help that I needed and deserved. And I know many, many people, especially those at the higher end of the weight spectrum, struggle with that, where it's really hard. You know, if you're like a higher weight person and you go to your doctor and you say, I think I might have an eating disorder, the weight stigma that you might encounter there could be really intense. And so knowing how to find trusted sources, I think, is really important. And so, you know, taking a quiz online from a reputable source, like the National Eating Disorders Association has a quiz online, I think, that you can take, a screening tool, is potentially one place to start. I have a list of providers on my website, christyharrison.com/providers, that are people that I've sort of vetted and, you know, had communications with about their approach to disordered eating and eating disorders, and you know, therapists and dietitians who could be helpful. But yeah, I think really seeking screening and then a proper diagnosis and treatment, I think, is really important. A couple of things that I will say, you know, beyond that, and of course this is not diagnosis, this is just like education, but to say that if you feel really rigid around food, such that you can't deviate from your typical eating routine or your typical exercise routine, you know, for a few days or for like a vacation, say you even get an opportunity to do like a 2-week vacation. And that causes a tremendous amount of anxiety and stress because you're like, oh no, I won't be able to eat my normal foods. I won't be able to do my usual exercise routine. Or you're like packing special foods for that trip beyond just like, oh, I'm going to have some snacks for the flight or like make sure that I have backup snacks or something like that. But like if you're packing all of your food to go somewhere, if you're not able to eat out, if you're not able to sort of be spontaneous and have meals with friends and, you know, do things with food that are not planned and rigid, I think that's a huge red flag. A big red flag, too, is if there's any sort of compensatory behavior, any sort of compensation. So if you're exercising to try to make up for what you've eaten, or if you're purging, or if you're using laxatives or diet pills or things like that, that is a huge red flag as well.
A lot of people asking your opinion on the keto diet.
Not a fan. There's not good evidence behind it. You know, there a lot of these diets, there's like some evidence in small groups of people or in, you know, in some cases, it's like in animals or in cells in a lab or something like that. With a keto diet, it's been, you know, small numbers of people. There's certainly evidence for it in very limited uses for children with epilepsy, but it is quite an extreme diet. It has been shown to have some benefit for children with epilepsy in reducing seizures, but the problem is that it's such an extreme diet that kids can't stay on it, that it can also cause havoc in their relationship with food and their bodies, sometimes with their digestion as well. And so even for that, which is sort of the best studied and best evidence-based use for it, it's not something that I would recommend. It's not something that I think providers should recommend across the board, except perhaps as like a last-ditch kind of treatment. And then these like the weight loss uses for it or the idea of, you know, sort of general wellness uses for it just don't have good evidence behind them.
Well said. Okay. As a chronic overeater, how can I change my habits successfully and long term to reduce my portion sizes?
That's such a great question. I get questions like this a lot. I think the first step to that is sort of reframing how you see yourself. So calling yourself a chronic overeater, I think is really, first, it's pathologizing, you know, it's making you feel ashamed and bad about yourself. And it's actually missing the root of the problem, which is restriction. So I think if anything, you can say, you know, I chronically restrict my eating, and then it leads to overeating, because that's really the course of things usually, you know, it's that people are, I really rarely, if ever, see overeating without some form of restriction first. And so restriction really begets rebound eating. I don't even say overeating because I find that term so pathologizing. So I say, you know, rebound eating or makeup eating, right? It's eating to make up for what you've restricted. And we see this a lot in people who are dieting, people who are trying to, you know, be quote unquote healthy, right? That flexible dietary control, who are like watching it and counting calories. Maybe they think they're not being rigid, which, you know, was me back in the day, right? I had moments of severe eating disorder pathology and then moments of like, I'm just kind of watching it and being flexible and, you know, just counting calories or just, you know, avoiding carbs or whatever it was. And no matter where I was falling on that continuum, I would still experience what I then called overeating, what I would now call, you know, rebound eating or makeup eating. So I think that the first step towards that is really getting underneath that, seeing how you're restricting, finding all the ways that you're, you know, following food rules, restricting yourself from eating enough, and then starting to eat more, starting to allow yourself to open up to more food in general and a greater variety of foods, dropping the food rules and not being so rigid.
So we have a lot of people asking about intermittent fasting or one meal a day. The general question says, can it be healthy? I must say, in the interest of full disclosure, I have practiced essentially some form of intermittent fasting for nearly a decade. So, you know, even if you say it's totally unhealthy, I do want to just like give that caveat to the audience because they've seen me talk about it on several occasions. Mm-hmm. So I want to be honest with them.
Yeah. Yeah. I am not a fan. I don't recommend it either. You know, again, there's like limited evidence in small groups of people that, you know, initially showed it had a benefit. And so that got a lot of researchers excited and sort of like everyday people really excited. And there were lots of books written about it and blogs and influencers and all the things. But then more recent research has really shown that intermittent fasting doesn't have any benefits and that, in fact, it in the long term can cause some harm. So not only, you know, all diets really really can cause disorder in people's relationships with food and put them at risk for eating disorders and you know, severely disordered eating. So that's one thing. But then in addition to that, people who do intermittent fasting can actually have muscle loss in the long term. And there's no benefit in terms of, I wouldn't even say benefit because I'm not a proponent of weight loss, but there's no increased weight loss with intermittent fasting compared to just sort of a regular diet. The research has shown that intermittent fasters and dieters on sort of a more traditional, you know, quote unquote healthy diet, lose about the same amount of weight and then regain the weight they lost, you know, over time, so that they kind of both revert to baseline. They both have sort of a reversion to baseline on any, you know, biomarkers that are changed as well. And so, you know, it's been interesting to see that research emerge and sort of, support the conclusions that I've seen clinically, which is that people just really can't stick to it and that it causes a lot of disorder in people's relationships with food. I think you're one of the exceptions of someone who has been able to stick to it for a really long time. But, you know, for most people, diets just really aren't sustainable in the long run. And there was an interesting interview with one of the researchers on one of these studies of intermittent fasting who said, you know, this researcher said, I had been intermittent fasting myself for 7 years. And I was really excited to do this research to show that, you know, the thing I had been doing for so long really worked and helped people. And as soon as I saw the data, I stopped because I saw how bad it was. I saw that it wasn't actually helpful. So that's, you know, some food for thought, I think, for anyone who's a proponent of intermittent fasting.
Yeah, I'm definitely, I try to be careful not to suggest what I do for other people. I also smoke a cigarette every now and again. I've hit a tanning booth this year. Like I have a lot of bad habits, not, you know, nothing out of moderation. But suffice to say, I think, you know, for me anyway, I was always someone who just never found myself hungry in the mornings ever. Mm-hmm. I never liked to eat in the mornings. I always kind of felt sick if I ate in the mornings since I was a little kid. And so for me, it always just felt much more natural to wait until 1-2 in the afternoon to eat. And I personally feel very good, but I also, for me, it was never really a question of like, is this, it was never really a question of like, oh, I'm going to start doing this now. It was more a question of just like, well, this is when I'm hungry, so I'm going to eat when I'm hungry and I'm not going to force myself to eat when I'm not hungry, which I had been doing prior, which I suppose in many ways probably dovetails more with intuitive eating than dieting.
Yeah, I think it's very individual. You know, I don't want to say across the board that that's a good thing, because I think there are situations where people's appetite might be suppressed for a variety of reasons that they do need to eat even when they're not hungry. And, you know, sometimes for scheduling reasons, we need to eat when we're not hungry. Or if you, for example, didn't feel hungry in the mornings, but you were really low energy by the time lunch rolled around and you were like had a headache and were constantly thinking about food or were really run down and tired or something like that, eating even when you weren't hungry might be an appropriate response to those things. But, right, you know, for you, if it's something where you've just never enjoyed it, you don't feel good eating in the morning and you don't have any negative repercussions and you're not doing it for like a diety reason, right? You're not doing it to lose weight or maintain weight or something like that. And you're just, you know, eating when you're hungry and maybe you're eating more at night or something. Maybe your day is sort of skewed such that you have all of the meals and all the energy that you would otherwise have with breakfast, but you just kind of eat it at different times of day. Maybe that's fine for you, you know. But in that case, I would encourage you not necessarily to identify it as intermittent fasting, you know, not to sort of identify with this diet, but to say, yeah, I'm doing intuitive eating. I'm doing something that works for me and my body, and I've kind of figured out what works, and that's it, you know.
I like to refer to myself as, I like to eat like a medieval king. Like I like to have a feast once a day. And so yeah, at night I always have a feast. And that's my vibe. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So many of our questions are some version of how do I avoid greenwashing? How do I know which labels actually make a difference? Like how do I navigate all of this like healthy washing in my grocery shopping? Like how do I know what I'm looking at?
Yeah, you know, that's not my area of expertise now. I actually used to, my first full-time job was as an editor at a eco lifestyle magazine. So I was really interested in that stuff back then. Also when I had an eating disorder and was super obsessed with, you know, finding the right, the most sustainable, the most, you know, eco-friendly of everything. So I think that's sort of an interesting parallel there too. But, you know, I would say that, like, just kind of relaxing about it and not being super concerned, you know, again, this idea of conscientious consumerism, I think, is a red herring in some ways and a distraction from some of the bigger things we could be doing. Like, what if we could take the time that we were spending worrying about which, you know, comparing labels in the grocery store and spend that like writing postcards to support a candidate who was going to, you know, enact better policies or something like that, right? Like, so that's one thing. And I think if, you know, we can just think about like doing the best we can with what we have and, you know, finding things that are good tasting to us and that bring us pleasure and joy and that are affordable and within our budget. And if they happen to have some sort of eco-friendly claim on them or something, maybe so much the better, who knows, right? You know, there are standards for what can be called organic. So if you buy something that's labeled USDA organic, you know that it's going to be, it's going to meet certain standards for environmental protection. Are those perfect? No, there's probably, you know, more that could be done with the environmental, with the organic standards. But, you know, if you have the money to do that and you want to buy something that supports that, that farm or whatever in creating organic food, go for it, you know. But I think just not getting too hung up on the minutia of anything is really a helpful approach in my view.
Any practical tips for disconnecting food and emotions, specifically for me, diminishing stress or sadness eating?
You know, I think, again, it goes back to the notion of being adequately fed overall. So what we see in the literature, and again, what I've experienced personally and seen in clients too, is that people who identify as emotional eaters, which I very much did back in the day, I was even working on a book about emotional eating. And that's how I stumbled on intuitive eating and sort of changed the whole course of my career. I was working on this book, you know, initially because I felt that I was an emotional eater and I was curious about kind of the cultural history of this concept. And what I've found, you know, in the years since in my deep dives into scientific research and clinical work is that people who identify as emotional eaters really aren't actually eating in response to emotions as much as they think they are, and that they're often instead eating in response to deprivation, eating in response to dieting, to having lots of rules about food, to thinking that certain foods are good and bad. They're, you know, often really critical of themselves for this perceived emotional eating and not necessarily eating actually that much more than other people overall, but that it might fall into that restrict binge or restrict rebound cycle that we were talking about where, you know, people are trying to restrict and trying to eat quote unquote healthy or clean or, you know, follow a certain diet or something and then end up eating a lot in response. And it can sort of seem to dovetail with perceived emotions, but or with emotions. But oftentimes, you know, stress can just sort of exhaust whatever willpower we were trying to exert, right? So there's a lot of effort in eating restrictively and in following a diet. And, you know, people think that they lack willpower when they stop being able to follow a diet. But really what it is that our eating shouldn't be governed by willpower in the first place. And that we do have sort of finite levels of willpower or like effort to be directed towards particular things. And once we sort of, you know, if we get to a certain level of stress or a certain level of sleep deprivation or, you know, just emotions, we can have that sort of level of effort be exhausted. And then we end up, you know, our inhibitions are lowered and we end up eating what our bodies really need, right? So like our bodies can sort of take over, our body's needs can really take over in those situations. And it can feel like, oh, I was just so stressed out and I ate my feelings. But actually what it was that, oh, I was really restricting and deprived and I was at a deficit and my body really needed the energy, but I was using all this effort to try to not eat. And then I got to a place where I was so stressed out that I stopped being able to do that. And then my body's needs took over and I was fed. You know, and so if we can sort of start to reframe it that way and start to try to eat, you know, more in the lead up to that and more in response. Also, a lot of times when people think of themselves as eating emotionally, they'll restrict on the back end too. They'll restrict in response to that and say, well, okay, diet starts tomorrow. I have to be good again tomorrow. I'm going to start restricting again. And, you know, it just restarts the whole cycle. So, you know, I'd encourage you again to sort of not label yourself as an emotional eater and not think of yourself as eating in response to emotions, but to say, where is the restriction? Where is the deprivation underneath that?
Well, Christy, we have so many more questions that I wish we had time to get to, but I know we have a stop. So I want to thank you for coming by and to remind everyone to please go pick up her new book, The Wellness Trap, which was, again, such a beloved pick for our book club. And for our audience who wants to follow you, where can they go to get more?
Yeah, thank you so much, Chelsea. It was really lovely to talk with you. And people can find me on the podcast apps. If they're listening to this on a podcast app, I'm there at Rethinking Wellness, which is my new podcast. You can go to rethinkingwellness.substack.com to get my newsletter. And you can find the book in all your local bookstores or online.
Wonderful. Thank you so much again for being here. And thank you guys all for tuning in. And we will see you back here next Monday for an all new episode of The Financial Confessions. Bye.